Dr. Paul, welcome to With the Wind, Science Revealed. Today I interview none other than Dr. Pierre Corey, author of The War on Ivermectin. This is a powerful message about what happened, why it happened, and how could this life-saving medication, ivermectin, that could have kept our population healthy and prevented the need even for the COVID jabs, be kept from the people. This is a powerful one. You don't want to miss a word. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. I've heard that what you resist persists. On a spiritual level, it makes total sense to me. I want to be about yes to things. I don't want to be a no person. I want to be positive. I want to be about love and about creating those sorts of positive things in my life. That's what I want. My challenge sometimes is I find myself that I live in this world where there's so much injustice. And in that world, it just feels like the loving thing to do is to fight for justice, fight for those who aren't getting justice, who don't have a voice. Martin Luther King put it so well, the only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Thanks to all of you out there loving and fighting for justice. Welcome, Dr. Pierre Corey, to With the Wind. What a pleasure it is to have you back on this show.
Absolutely. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
You are the author of the book, The War on Ivermectin, right there, medicine that saved millions and could have ended the pandemic. I just spent the last 2 days reading that. I could barely put it down. Wow, what a masterpiece. It totally explains a lot of what we went through the last 3 years, certainly what I went through as a doctor trying to figure this all out. You're a pulmonary and critical care medicine specialist, really at the top of your game, board certified in both those specialties. Wow, were you positioned to be ready for this COVID pandemic? On top of that, you're a pioneer in critical care ultrasonography. I found that fascinating. You just went right there to get the expertise at the bedside using ultrasound. What a gift to critical care. You've authored so many books, published so many articles. Co-founded, president, chief medical officer of the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, FLCCC. I have leaned on you guys for what to do from the moment you guys put out Math Plus. I wasn't aware of it initially, but as soon as I stumbled on it, I asked, my gosh, what a gift you gave to the world. And yet you were, of course, persecuted for that. You co-authored 10 plus COVID-19 peer-reviewed articles. You're one of the world's leading experts in both the disease and the role of ivermectin in early treatments. So I think you're one of the masters and you've won departmental teaching awards, multiple institutions, co-founder and chief medical officer of the Leading Edge Clinic. I wish I'd known about that earlier. Private telehealth practice, where you treat both common and complex medical conditions and specialize in COVID-19 vaccine injury and long COVID, which sometimes I think are hard to distinguish. And I think, is it true people will access that at drpierrecorey.com?
Yeah, if they need care, that's my private practice. Okay. But yeah, go there and if they need my help, we're happy to help.
Yeah. What's so special about you is not only are you a leading academic, author, and all of that, but you're in the trenches seeing patients. And you were taking care of the sickest patients during certainly the biggest health crisis in the last century. I like what you read, that anybody who thought COVID-19 was the enemy, Dr. Corey's book will leave no doubt that the true adversary in this war is a collective cabal of power-hungry elites who put profits over people and will stop at nothing in their quest for control. That says it all right there. We're going to delve into that in our discussion here. We share a couple of interesting commonalities that you mentioned in your book about being in grad school and working on a CDC-funded project to increase immunizations. I've been caught up in that a couple times. In fact, when I was in grad school, I went to Sierra Leone on a World Health Organization polio vaccine campaign.
Oh, wow.
So yes, I thought I was doing the best thing I could for the world.
Yep.
Let's start with, we'll jump back maybe into your background later if we have time, but I'm very curious, being a top critical care pulmonologist and having those two perfectly positioned expertises for handling COVID, talk to us about some of the key moments, because you were mainstream.
Yeah.
My understanding is 3-4 years ago, you were totally mainstream, while back, I was the same. I trusted everything that came out of the CDC and the NIH and everything I read in journals. Something happened to you, as I could tell reading your book. Walk us through that a little bit.
I came up with a protocol to treat myself in case I got sick, like immediately. So we started working and studying, but that transformation, so you use the term mainstream. I've been using the term a system doctor, meaning a doctor who works in that medical system, literally within a health system, which I didn't realize was a highly curated and controlled space. It's way more now than it was. I still had autonomy to do whatever I wanted in the ICU. I've never been told I could or couldn't use a medicine that I thought was indicated. But let's talk about that cabal, right? So that corrupt cabal, I will say that before COVID, I knew I didn't like big pharma. I knew that they did a lot of untoward and even sometimes criminal activities. But I thought of their corruption that was mostly like on the edges with like the pens, the dinners, the trips, that stuff. I didn't realize that's nothing compared to what really happens and the way that industry controls medicine. And my expertise in COVID revealed to me nothing made sense. No policy I saw issued by any agency from day one made any scientific sense. And so as a scientist or as a researcher who had access to all of this data, I'm seeing policies completely divorced from the data. So the attacks on hydroxychloroquine, the attacks on ivermectin, this endless promotion of these vaccines that were so toxic coming out of the gate.
Right.
They should have been shut down within 2 weeks. The deaths were climbing, the adverse events were climbing, but yet you just saw this. And I like the fact that you used the word cabal, because it was very coordinated. The entire management of COVID, it was the agencies. Actually, I'll start differently. It was the high impact medical journals selectively publishing positive reports of vaccines, selectively publishing negative reports on hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. And then along with those journals, the agencies, and then the media. And when you had that unholy alliance and the fearsome power they exerted, they literally fed us propaganda for 3 years and told us lies. They told us work that worked, and they told us the vaccines were safe and effective, and they weren't. And so I got to see just how the scope and the scale of the control and corruption of the medical sciences, and I would say the foundation of the corruption is, and if you read my book, part of how I present this war on ivermectin is in the framework of what's called the disinformation playbook, right? Which is an article written 5-6 years ago, which details the tactics that industries employ when science emerges that's inconvenient to their interests. And that was, the disinformation playbook was invented by the tobacco industry or perfected by the tobacco industry. For 50 years, they tried to convince the world that smoking wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
And that no definitive evidence that it was bad for you. That was an outrageous goal. And they had managed to succeed for 50 years until the master settlement agreement. But those tactics that they employed, the most devastating one, and they're named after American football plays, but the one that's called the fix is the most damaging. And the fix is where they design and conduct trials with predetermined results.
Mm-hmm.
And I make the point in the book that there's 97 controlled trials of ivermectin, the summary analysis of which show massive reductions in death, hospitalization, time to clinical recovery, time to viral clearance. But yet the world only heard of what I call the big six. Those were six trials. They're the only trials that were conducted by teams of investigators that are totally conflicted with the pharmaceutical industry. They were large, they were considered high quality, and they're the only ones that were published in the high impact journals. And they've been doing that for decades around a lot of repurposed drugs. And once you have a high impact journal with a large, supposedly high quality trial, that becomes one of the commandments. That is a truth, a scientific truth, and all the doctors follow it. And you saw how nobody was reading these papers critically. Nobody was paying enough attention to see the absolute manipulations and shenanigans that they had to do to bury the evidence of efficacy. And so now I'm estranged from that system. I don't trust anything anymore. I can't trust a high impact medical journal on both ways. They're going to tell me something doesn't work, and then they're going to tell me something is safe and effective when it's not. And they've been doing that for decades. And so I'm outside that system now. I'm in private practice. I don't have a boss. I don't have an institution tell me what I can and can't do. And I got to tell you, medicine's fun again, and it's really challenging and it's really inspiring because we're trying to figure out this terrible disease of long COVID and vaccine injury syndromes. And it requires autonomy for me to treat. I could never treat my patients the way I'm doing now if I was employed by a health system.
I had a similar journey with the vaccine story, right? So they would, I called it tobacco science. They would just create these trials, what you're calling the fix, and those would get publicized and all the other information that was showing we had problems just get swept under the rug and maligned.
Yeah, right. Which is this constant refrain that there is no evidence that vaccines are related to autism, which is absolutely absurd. They are completely complicit in the autism epidemic. We have tons of data to show that, but the only things that get published are these manipulated studies, epidemiologic studies showing no association. And that becomes the law of the land. And if you see anything different, you're a crank, you're a fringe, you're a quack, right?
Yeah. Mention the names of some of the high impact journals that you're pretty clear are, from your data and research, are conflicted.
Yes. So the top five in the world, which is by their impact factor, an impact factor is a metric which measures how often papers are cited from that journal. So the more you get cited, the more important the journal is. And the number one journal in the world is the New England Journal of Medicine. They published the most manipulated and fraudulent trial of all of the big six. And let me go further. That trial also won Trial of the Year from the Clinical Trialist Society. But this is how bad it's gotten. Not only was it published in the New England Journal, but it literally won an award for the best trial of the year.
When it's totally manipulated.
It's so brazenly fraudulent. The researchers will not make the data public. They're hiding the individual patient level data because they know a whole bunch of us around the world are onto them. We've seen all of the shenanigans they pulled and they're hiding. They say multiple times in the paper that the data will be posted publicly. They won't do it because we know they manipulated data. So that gives you, New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of the American Medical Association, The Lancet, the British Medical Journal, and Annals of Internal Medicine. But for me, it was really JAMA and NEJM that did the most damage to ivermectin. And you've read my book. There's another chapter where I show numerous emails from colleagues of mine that did ivermectin trials, which found statistically significant benefits.
Yeah.
And all of the journals said, no, thank you. This is not of sufficient interest to our readers at this time, which is their boilerplate language when they reject your paper. But these are people from top universities, from different countries, from Nigeria and Israel. And the journals are saying, we're not interested in your positive ivermectin study.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so brazen.
Given you are, and I am so grateful for ivermectin and so grateful for people like you who made it clear that was the thing to do, despite us, this blitz, as you say, of negative information. They've got the diversion, the fix, the fake, the screen. You could go through those briefly, but tell our audience why ivermectin works, because maybe you can explain a little bit layman's terms on how it works and why it works.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the initial confusion, because everybody was like, why would you use ivermectin against the virus? Because it's known as an anti-parasite drug, because it even won the Nobel Prize for that. So it has a mechanism of action against parasites. It has actually 20 different beneficial mechanisms of action. And how many are important, it's hard to tell. I could just tell it works. But I think the most important mechanisms are, number one, and actually, let me say something else. When I first started studying ivermectin, I knew it as an anti-parasite, but I was shocked when I found 10 years of in vitro studies showing that it stopped the replication of about a dozen RNA viruses, West Nile, Zika, dengue, influenza. And so it had all of this efficacy in vitro in inhibiting the replication. And then, it's not a surprise, COVID is an RNA virus. And you could see that there were studies showing that it had the tightest binding capacity to the spike protein. So for whatever reason, conformationally bound spike protein, once you bind the spike, can't get into the cell, can't infect you. So it's a very good prophylactic. It also inhibits several enzymes, protease enzymes that virus needs to replicate. And so it inhibits replication in about three or four different mechanisms that could do that. And then it has these potent anti-inflammatory properties. So it's literally, you could not have designed a better drug. It works in prevention, early treatment, and even late with inflammation. And one of the fascinating mechanisms is it inhibits or attaches to a receptor on the red blood cell, which prevents red blood cells from aggregating. Because that's something that we were seeing in COVID. Some of the oxygenation problems were because the red blood cells were not circulating in the blood freely. They were clumping together in these aggregates and causing kind of sludging. And ivermectin would disperse these aggregates. And you could see oxygenation improve within sometimes minutes to hours of administration. And so it's a fascinating drug with lots of mechanisms. And I think it was Paul who said it was a gift from God. Like, you could not have designed a better medicine for COVID, but you also couldn't imagine a medicine that was more attacked. And that's the other question. You didn't ask it, but I'm going to ask it for you. People ask them, why did they want to go after ivermectin so bad? And that's really the point of the book is that, and I try to make a case, this book, although it's about ivermectin, it's really just a case study in a decades-long war on repurposed, off-patent, safe alternative therapies. And
a war on the people, even.
It's war on the people, but it primarily it's to destroy this drug, because this drug would have obliterated the markets, which opened up tens of billions for the vaccines, Paxlovid, remdesivir, molnupiravir. All of those markets would have been gone if ivermectin was widely deployed, and they had to destroy it. And so it threatened the entire vaccine campaign, as well as these pricey pharmaceuticals. And you could see how they did, why and how they did that. And so you have one of the most effective drugs in a global pandemic, which was destroyed across media, agencies, and journals.
Yeah.
And it's not new though, right? I wrote the book, The War on Ivermectin. Someone could write the book, The War on Hydroxychloroquine. It's the same tactic, same story, same conclusion. One was in 2020, the other one was in 2021. And they've been doing this for decades. They have to attack the older drugs so that the standard of care is the new pricey patented pharmaceutical.
Yeah. Your book shares the success stories of ivermectin in various countries, India, for example, and how they went after those countries to get it off the market there. This thing, we knew SARS-1 and MERS, that this was actually an effective drug against these coronaviruses, right? And had we deployed it, they couldn't have authorized emergency use of the vaccine. They wouldn't have needed it.
Exactly. That's if they play by the rules. I think they can change the rules as they go. But yes, on paper, that's the biggest threat, is that if you had an effective therapy available to all, that vaccine would never gotten out off the ground with that speed. And many lives would have been saved as a result.
Yeah. So Paul Merrick is one of your running mates there at FLCCC. And I remember reading about your guys' paper on intravenous vitamin C in the ICU and how that turned around sepsis. And I remember medical school days, and I was a hospitalist for a while initially before I went into primary care. Sepsis was a big deal, and who would have thought? A lowly vitamin. How did you manage to get that published, and what happened with that work?
What's interesting about the vitamin C saga is that it has so many parallels to what happened to us in COVID. When Paul was doing research, he came across some small studies showing these really large magnitude benefits of intravenous vitamin C in septic shock. And he came up with a little protocol, decided to try it himself. And his first two patients that he treated responded so dramatically that we're experts because we have pattern recognition. We've treated the same disease over and over, hundreds of patients, decades. And then when you see a pattern which completely is discordant from what you're used to seeing, it's very recognizable. And so Paul then, immediately after two patients, made it his protocols. Everyone with septic shock, he was going to treat. He treated 47. He compared them to 47 patients that he had treated prior to starting this protocol. And it showed a reduction in mortality from 40% down to 8%, which there's really no medicines that we've discovered that reduces mortality in any disease model to that extent. It's literally a life. He was able to publish it. I don't know that you could publish a study like that anymore, because it was what's called the retrospective observational study. And that's another part of the corruption of medicine, is they are trying to get rid of those studies. They only want heavily funded, pharma-conflicted researchers from top universities doing these large double-blind randomized controlled trials. And as Paul, large double-blind randomized controlled trials are completely a faulty design.
Yeah.
And you know why they're faulty design? Is because the bias of the funders negates any value to the structure of that study. Yep. The bias of the funders screams through those studies. And that's why they don't want retrospective observational trials. You know why? You know who can do those kind of trials? Lowly doctors like us. And they don't want us doing research and finding out things that are inconvenient to them. And that's what happened with vitamin C. So Paul got it published and it created quite an uproar. People, and I say it in the book, I didn't believe it. And I didn't know Paul at the time. Actually, Paul and I became good colleagues and friends over what I discovered about vitamin C later on. But when I first saw the paper, it was so ludicrous. I was sick of vitamin trials. They're all negative. They've been published in literature for years on any disease. They're all negative, which I now know is fraudulent, right? So if you look at the vitamin D research over decades, they have polluted that with so many pharma-conflicted studies trying to bury evidence of vitamin D. But I was a full believer that vitamins were overstated, they're fraudulent and nonsense. And so I didn't pay attention to that paper. And then it was like almost a year later, I was having a really bad week in the ICU, had a patient who was dying, the family was begging me to try something or anything. And I was like, let me try this MARIC protocol. And so I tried it. It didn't have any effect on the first patient because he was literally almost near dead. And so I didn't take any negative conclusions from that. Tried it on someone else who was actually going to the OR and to a different service. And I thought I saw some significant improvement within that hour after I started it. And then it was my third patient where I saw what Paul had seen when he started using it. I saw a neutropenic bone marrow transplant patient completely resurrect in a span of 18 hours from multi-organ failure to sitting up, eating eggs, talking to his wife, full Foley bag of urine, and he was being wheeled back to the bone marrow transplant floor the very next morning. He came in at 11 a.m. on a Tuesday, and he got sent back to his floor on Wednesday. He had 4 out of 4 E. coli growing in his blood with 0 white cells.
Oh, my word. When have you ever seen that happen?
Never. And so after day, I got transformed. But let me just hurry up and say, what happened next should be predictable. Anyone listening to this conversation. So what happened next is funding came in for large, double-blind, randomized controlled trials. And the first one published, Journal of the American Medical Association, somehow found 0 effect MARIC's protocol.
And you figured out how, didn't you?
Within seconds, you could see it because what I had done in the interim is after I got interested in myself and some doctors on my service started treating everyone with it. Now, this is another interesting point. I was the chief of critical care service at the University of Wisconsin. I had about 17 intensivists on my service. And when I presented to them all the data showing the critical need for intravenous vitamin C in sepsis, I would say only 4 of the 17 actually thought it was reasonable and employed it as part of the report. The rest of them were like, this is nonsense. They didn't want to get into giving vitamins to patients. They just dismissed it. And of those 4, 1 was my wife, so it doesn't really count. But we had enough people being treated that we looked at the data and we found this incredible signal in the data, which is that as long as you start, at least the doses we use, as long as you start like the MARIC protocol, which is IV vitamin C, corticosteroids, and IV thiamine, if you started within 6 hours, basically nobody died. If you did it within 12 hours, you had a large reduction in mortality. But after 12 hours, you didn't have real big changes in mortality. It's really late to be treated early. And that's from arrival in emergency room. And what did they do in that big trial? They treated patients like up to 30 hours into septic shock.
Then they'd start,
which is
too late.
No critical care doctor would ever start something that late into a life-threatening disease. And so basically, but then other trials were published, all did the same thing, gave it late. And now we have a body of literature of high quality, double-blind, randomized controlled trials, all proving IV vitamin C doesn't work in sepsis.
Yeah.
They did that to us.
And that's what they advertise in the news. And
yeah, so this is not our first rodeo. And let me give you another cool anecdote because I just heard it the other day. So I was on a lecture tour in Hawaii and I was lecturing with a colleague of mine who's an osteopath. And he told me that the hospital that he trained in his residency, the main intensivist there used IV vitamin C in the MARIC protocol on everyone. The emergency room used it, the ICU used it. And he said during his training, he didn't think sepsis was a big deal. He didn't pay a lot of attention to sepsis because patients wouldn't get that sick and they would get better pretty quickly. And he said it only took him like later in his career to realize that sepsis is a very serious and life-threatening disease. But his experience in training was that the patients were uncomplicated. They got well pretty quickly. And that's because he trained in a place where it was the standard of care. And so it's truly remarkable what happens. And it's truly saddening, the amount of corruption. But that's what they do. They destroy cheap, effective, widely available therapies because it will not make them money.
So you came out, were instrumental in the development, I believe, of the Math Plus protocols.
Yes.
And I remember sharing those with, I have a good friend who's a nurse in an ICU in our local hospital. The doctors there wouldn't look at it. How is it that you could come up with a protocol that has amazing benefit and we can't even get our colleagues to look at it?
Because I'll go back to that randomized controlled trial stuff, right? This evolution of evidence-based medicine, which in its founding concepts should have been a huge positive to the practice of medicine, which is that there's an agreement that we need to study the therapies that we use for both safety. We need more trials, better trials, and we need to study things. And the evidence to support treatments should rise those treatments. And so the problem is that now that we've had evidence-based medicine as the dominant sort of research and study of medicine, it's evolved into this nihilism, which is nobody wants to use any new medicine unless it has this huge trial to support it. So the art of medicine is gone, the mystery, the making decisions based on mechanistic and physiologic reasoning, and you have a safe medicine that you think could work and to try it. Doctors don't do that anymore. They wait for these trials and the guidelines to tell them what to do. And it's the saddest thing I've ever seen because they're not exploring or trying out really effective, safe therapies. They're just waiting around for these trials. And you're right. You bring a protocol like Math Plus, the average system doctor, their head's going to explode because they're going to look. It's a combination of therapies, right? We have like literally math is four different medicines. And then the plus, we have different supplements and nutraceuticals. I don't even know how they can wrap their head around it. There's no evidence for this, is what they would say. There's no trials to support this combination. How could you use this combination? This is, what do they say? One doctor was quoted saying, oh, it's like throwing spaghetti at the wall, right? I'm hoping something sticks. And we also could never get our data out. Like the mortality rates at Paul's Hospital and Joe, who's another FLCCC member, they were starting Mass Plus as soon as the patients walked in the door of the hospital. And they had these absurdly low mortality rates, like between 4 and 6% for COVID at a time in that first year when you saw anywhere from 30 to 50 to 80% mortality. Yeah. In the hospital. But nobody would let us talk about it. They would not print it in interviews because it doesn't come out of some big study.
Wow. So you're at the top of your game. You are the specialist in critical care and pulmonary, which is lung medicine. You're perfectly positioned to do what needs to happen for patients. What happened to your jobs? I was reading in your book, I think you might have lost two or three of them.
Yeah, three. I'll give you the rundown. My first job, which was, I was at the very high level academic medical center, University of Wisconsin, one of the biggest research institutions in the country. And I was the chief of the service and I was the head of the ICU. And I actually resigned from that job. I had resigned about a month and a half into COVID for a very simple reason. I had a moral and ethical objection to what they were doing. They were advocating supportive care only. Mm-hmm. And I was actively being blocked and talked over when I was suggesting things like using blood thinners on these patients that were clotting like crazy. Using corticosteroids when all of the organizations around the world are saying don't use steroids. But you could see these patients were dying. They were not getting better. I'd never seen patients stay so long on a ventilator without any improvements, just these slow declines. And you could see there was a lack of treatment. So because they were really blocking me from advocating for treatment, and I actually got IV vitamin C on the University of Wisconsin's COVID-19 protocol. I actually got it on there because out of all the therapies we had for severe lung injury, there's actually good data for vitamin C. And the problem is the chair of medicine went behind my back and convened the committee again to remove it. Hmm. So, and this is a new chair of medicine, just took over the department. And once she did that, which was essentially she committed academic misconduct, and I was livid. And they were telling me that I couldn't use any medicines because the guidelines don't say to use anything. I said, I refuse to be a clinical leader if this is the institutional approach. And so I resigned. Yeah. The second job happened after I got a job at a major medical center in Milwaukee. And there I gave my ivermectin testimony, which went viral. And they accused me of speaking for the institution. And they immediately furnished me with a new contract, which had about 7 different restrictions on my First Amendment rights. And I said, no, thank you. At that point, I was part of a medical education organization. We were giving a lot of interviews, a lot of guidance to doctors and people around the country on how to treat this. And I would have had to ask them for permission to talk to anyone at any time. And wow. So I said, no, thank you. So that was a kind of a mutual departure. And then I ended up doing locum tenens work where I was an independent contractor. And my third job, my last job in the system, I loved that job. I was in central Wisconsin. I had a ton of autonomy. That my partners, the group, the ICU group that hired me, loved me. They'd all read my book on ultrasound. And I was teaching them all these things I knew about COVID. We'd get along great. But the administration was putting increasing pressure on the ICU group to get rid of Corey. Get rid of Corey. And they were sending them hit job media pieces on how I'm like a fringe, a quack. And they actually stood firm. They said, if Corey goes, we go. And they have a lot of trouble recruiting up there. So they protected me for about 6 months. And I don't know what changed, but one day my friend and colleague who ran the ICU, he just called me up and he said, Pierre, I'm sorry, but we don't need you anymore. And there had been an invented complaint that I told someone to not get vaccinated or something. It was an invention because the details of, I have said that to people, but I didn't say it to who they think I said it to and where I said. So I knew it was invented and that's what they used to fire me.
Wow. I liked one thing you said earlier in our interview, that you're more excited now about medicine than ever before. I'm with you, buddy. I left mainstream, when I realized what was going on with vaccines and vaccine injury and the ability to help kids, in my case, as a pediatrician, get better from conditions that sometimes you're being written off, that there's no hope, which is what you saw with COVID so often. It was just come in, don't do anything, get hooked up to a ventilator and die. There's so much you can do. It's exciting.
It is exciting. It's so freeing. And I'm learning about so many different interventions and therapies that they don't teach you in medical school, right? And the term they use, right? Now I'm in this alternative space. I got to say, the word alternative to a system doctor is a 4-letter word. Yep. Now I see it as this beautiful kind of it's so rich and robust with knowledge and understandings of illness and different understandings on how to approach chronic illness, acute illness. And there's so many different therapies that you can use that I'm finding really good benefits with. And so it's almost like I'm repeating my training. I'm almost like a reformed physician. I'm a physician in recovery and I'm going to training. The only problems with alternative medicine is, and these are probably vestiges of my system training, is that there's just not great published clinical data on a lot of the therapies. And it makes me a little nervous. I just want a little bit more data to show efficacy rather than a colleague I trust who's, I do this and it works really well. Potent therapies, you don't need a trial to tell you something works. And that's for sure. I've discovered treatments that you don't need a trial for, but it's a shame. But that's also how the system is, right? They can't do those studies and get them published because they're not going to be published. So but it's fascinating. I really like being out here.
I can tell you, if the viewers are watching your face, which I get to watch, you are a spark of light and love and passion. And you see the look on most of the doctors walking around the hospitals these days and they're like zombies.
Yes.
It's night and day. And I think people are waking up to the fact that we need to go to doctors like yourself who really get it and are there passionate for their well-being. This one-size-fits-all medicine is a disaster.
I like what you just said. They not only look like zombies, but they act like them. So many people come up to me, like when I go speak or go to a conference, and they say to me, I don't want to go to my doctor anymore. I'm scared of the hospital. I'm scared of my doctor. And you know what? You know why they're scared? Is because they know the real data and story around these vaccines. And they go to a doctor, even a doctor they've seen for 15 years, and the doctor's trying to jab them and boost them and triple boost them. And the doctors are all saying it's safe and effective. And we're now in Omicron. COVID is like a bad cold at this point. And they're still jamming. And when the patients are now seeing the doctors repeating what they're told, which are lies, and literally recommending treatments which are bad for their health, of course they want to run away from the doctors. And then they are looking for doctors like you and me, who are critical thinkers, much more open-minded, and we assess the data as objectively as we can. And that's what they need. They need more of that, not just protocol, not doctors who are fed protocols and told what to treat and never going off protocol. Medicine is scary right now.
We need an alternative parallel system.
Yes.
I vote you're going to lead the ICU part of that, the critical care part, because you've been in those trenches and you know how to navigate the sickest patients.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they would do thousands of percent better.
Oh, there's not even a question. Me and Paul could run an ICU together. I could say some boastful things, but I would tell you, we would lose almost no one to sepsis for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. No, we need to make somebody out there who's got the money, put those two in charge of the ICU. Let's get some key people in all the departments, and we can put an institution that people will fly from all over the world to get the proper kind of care. I want to touch a little bit on childhood vaccines. That's been near and dear to my journey. What are your thoughts? How has that evolved for you?
Yeah. So let's trace the transformation. So prior to COVID, fully vaccinated, kids fully vaccinated. Never, ever question vaccines, because it's clear that they are the backbone of pediatric health and the eradication of diseases around the world. Well,
that's what we were taught, right?
That's what we were taught. And I had no reason to disbelieve or to investigate, because I don't. And really, the people who do, there are people who either have family members who are vaccine injured, or their doctors who are seeing clear vaccine injury and are willing to be open-minded and say, what is going on? But I had never had that experience that led me to question vaccines. After I deeply studied the COVID vaccine and I saw what an outrageous criminal fraud that intervention was, I started looking into the childhood vaccines. And for me, the book, Turtles All the Way Down, was absolutely transformative. And the thing is, me reading that book, after telling you what I've been through with vitamin C, with ivermectin, that book essentially describes the same things as I do in my book with ivermectin. Fraudulent studies, censored studies that never appear in the literature.
Yep.
Manipulated studies showing that these are safe. The idea that they've never been tested against a true placebo to hide this adverse effects. And then the most dramatic is this myth that we've been handed down, not even in medical school, in school, that these historic childhood viral illnesses were eradicated with vaccines. It's a complete falsehood. Almost all of the reduction in mortality in cases from all of those illnesses was through sanitation, water supply, hygiene, and plumbing. That's what got rid of those diseases. But yet we're told that those diseases were eradicated with vaccines. So you find that the childhood vaccine and vaccine schedule is built on a huge pile of, I'm sorry, I got to call it lies.
Yeah.
And obfuscations and suppression of adverse event data. And it's just propaganda, but it's fed to all the doctors, to the media. You see some of the questions that Bobby gets from media people. It's already definitively proven that the vaccines are not associated with autism. They say these grandiose statements that are crafted and controlled by pharma. And so I'll end by saying this. If I had young children today, they would not get one single childhood vaccine, not one. Period. End of story. Now, let me tell you something a bit sad. I told you that ivermectin's not my first rodeo. Well, vitamin C was a rodeo. But I need to tell you that in 2015, I have three daughters, and one of my daughters fell catastrophically ill with what we used to call PANDAS, which we now call PANS. And actually, two of my three daughters got extremely ill. And the journey that I had to go through to get them better from a disease that was making them so sick and that's not recognized, the doctors, none of them would make the diagnosis. None of them were taught that this thing exists. In fact, they were taught that it's a made up disease. And I didn't know at the time that I went through that journey that that disease exploded, coincident with the explosion in the vaccine schedules. I only learned in the past year that I do have two vaccine-injured children. Now, luckily, they are fully better, healthy, and normal, but they were really ill. And I'm also on the board of a nonprofit. It used to be called the Foundation for Children with Neuroimmune Disorders. Now it's called neuroimmune.org. But our whole mission is educating doctors how to diagnose and treat this condition, because there's a lot of kids with it. I'm sure as a pediatrician, you face off with that in your own practice.
Oh, yeah. No, we saw PANS, PANDAS, and all the autoimmune things just going through the roof the last decade and a half.
Yep. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, that's my take on the childhood vaccines. So in fact, this weekend at a Jewish organization, I'm giving a lecture on childhood vaccines, and I'm shamelessly plagiarizing the Turtles All the Way Down, and I reference it. I just say everything you need to know about the science of childhood vaccines, the history is in that book.
Yeah. Reading that book was like a summary of my journey the last 25 years. It was exactly what I went through. Suzanne Humphrey's book, Dissolving Illusions, was a good wake-up call to that history part of it that we weren't told when we were in medical school. I'm going to wrap it up with you here with where do we go from here?
I think you already mentioned it. I do think it's a parallel system. I think private practice has to grow, come back. My practice is a fee-based practice, which brings its challenges for the average citizen, right? Not everyone can afford to pay fees to see the doctor, but there are now novel ways of getting that covered, right? There's Medishare type organizations, which can get you to do fee-based care. And so I think some of those stuff, but I do think I don't think we can reform that system or correct that system. It's too powerful. The information is too controlled. People, even after COVID, the implicit faith and trust in the institutions of science and medicine is still there. For many doctors and many people, I don't know how they pulled that off. Because for a lot of us,
incredible. Yes. My mom got the jabs, three of them, ended up developing idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. You're a pulmonologist. They had no clue. They never even asked whether or not she had any COVID shots. She was on zero medications, had never smoked other than a few days back in her 20s. And it got her.
Yeah. And so even your mom decided she needed three vaccines, which I'm sure she may or may not have asked your opinion, but...
Oh, I tried to give it to her.
Yeah, no.
How could I be right and all the other doctors be wrong?
That's exactly it. And that's what I found. Anytime you stray from the herd with an opinion that departs from consensus, you have something wrong with you. And I'm sitting there being like, they're all crazy. And you never want to be the one guy in a room that's calling everyone else crazy, but...
Right.
That's the position I found myself. I was like, what are they doing? They've lost their minds.
Yeah.
And day after day, I wake up to find some new absurdity. But you're right. You think differently than all the other doctors, so you're the one who must be wrong.
Correct.
That's not how science works.
So how can people reach you?
Yeah. So for my private practice, it's drpierrecorey.com. That's K-O-R-Y. Our nonprofit, where we put out a lot of information on COVID and now on other aspects, like Paul Marrick just did a scientific monograph. He spent months reviewing the top 20 repurposed treatments for cancer. So there's a cancer monograph on it. So that's slccc.net. And I'm sure you're aware of the explosion in cancers in the wake of this vaccine campaign. And so we think that's really relevant to people. Yeah. And so that's my private practice, my nonprofit. And then I also write on Substack, which is pierrecorey.substack.com. Or medical musings if people want to. And then, of course, my book.
Yes.
You got to get what really happens.
You got to get this book. It's impressive. Thank you so much
for
being on the show.
Pleasure as always.
Hi, Dr. Corey. Thank you for joining me and being willing to talk to me of all people.
Pleasure. No, anytime. I'm glad to be here.
Great. So you're a dad. I'm a mom. I heard you talking already a little bit with Dr. Paul. You answered some of the questions I would normally ask you as a father. So how do you see yourself approaching? Because you said you would never vaccinate. If you had another child now, you wouldn't vaccinate that child. You would understand certain things. So your daughters are not quite at that age yet. When they start to get to a certain point, when are you going to start talking to them about childhood vaccines and different vaccines? Or do you already have that conversation? What's the relationship with your girls right now when it comes to what's happening?
So they're now 12, 17, and 18. So they're past all of them. They have been living in this house through COVID, and they've seen what I've been up against and the war that I've been fighting around ivermectin. But they also know my opinion on vaccines. And two of them have what we think are vaccine injury syndromes. They had severe PANS and PANDA. So I will say in my case with my daughters, they know to be very cautious. And I don't think any of them are interested in vaccines, and largely through my work and because of their medical histories. But yeah, I think for us as a family, that's not a big discussion I have. They know what my opinion is, and they know what my wife's opinion is. And my wife's opinion is actually not born from the study of all the data on childhood vaccines. It's her opinion is because of what happened to our children, because they get severe PANS and PANDAs. And yeah, we would never put an antigen with an immunogen in them. They had severe autoimmune diseases. And so, yeah, is that a fair answer?
It is. And it's a history of that. And it's the same thing with my son's absolutely against it because of having his own vaccine injury. And I was severely a vaccine injured as a child. And back then, I just had smallpox. That was it. So my question, though, is just being a dad, what do you say to the parents out there that don't have vaccine injured children yet? So you just said it. We don't change how we think until it affects us, until it's in our world, it's our children. And after seeing what you went through with your children, if you were going to be a Dr. Paul now and go into pediatrics and talk to these families, would you be afraid of saying what's going on or with it? How would you approach that?
No, I would not be afraid. That's just who I am. I've always been an educator. I speak freely about my opinions, the data, and I'm willing to discuss anything with everyone, anyone, openly as much as possible. But however, having said, that's still a really difficult discussion because of the environment that we live in. Most school systems require a litany of vaccines. And so when you're giving advice to a patient or a parent, which has implications far beyond that medical intervention, almost like with COVID, the coercion, the loss of employment, and all of these things, you're basically, in many states, telling the parent that they have to homeschool their kids right, in order to avoid vaccination. But I would have those discussions, and I would strongly recommend that every parent read Turtles All the Way Down. I think that is the most accurate and comprehensive resource for really understanding the lack of science to support these massive vaccination schedules.
Right.
And a lack of safety in it. But at the same time, it's so serious, like autism, right? It was like 1 in 1,000 33 decades ago. And now it's like 1 in 30 or even lower than that. When you see autism, that's not a cold or a pneumonia that you get over in a week. That is these are lifelong, disabled, completely dependent children. I have patients in my practice who are parents of vaccine-injured autistic kids. And they are scared of growing older because they're really scared of they know how to take care of their kids, are used to them. And if they were to leave this earth, they feel like they're going to abandon their children without the care that those kids need. And there's nothing more tragic than that. And you're upending people's lives. Spend the rest of your life taking care of it's an inflammatory brain disorder, brain injured child. It's terrifying.
No, and I think one of the things, I know I have to go, so I'm going to wrap it up. And you're such a compassionate man. And I heard you guys talk about how the doctors walk around in zombies and so forth. And the kids that come into our practice, Dr. Paul's Vaccine Friendly book was so great at that time because it's helped a lot of people navigate that. I don't feel like I have to vaccinate. I have to do something. But I don't want to hurt my children, injure my children. So the studies, and I was going to tell you, I heard you're speaking soon. Use his slides. They're really good. And share just even children who are vaccinated on an alternative schedule or slowing down or certain ones. They're still affected. They're not as healthy as the children who are unvaccinated. And that's what our world should be looking at. So doctors like you are amazing. Keep up the good work. Let me know if I can do anything for you. Because it's really important. And I don't know about you, but for me, being a parent, and especially a parent of a child that was vaccine affected and what they went through, and so glad that they're healthy now, I think that's, for me, that's what drives me. And I see in you, when I met you the first time, which I've met you twice, and I'm sure you don't remember me, but I saw the dad. I saw the man who wants to make a difference. Please keep that up. Please keep going.
We have to keep fighting for our health and our safety because, yeah, the whole vaccine industry is, it's not about protecting our health. It's about profits. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep fighting for truth and really safety and promoting good health, even if those opinions are unpopular. Don't get vaccinated.
Right. And it is unpopular. But again, I think I pray every day and I always try and see the good. And I just keep feeling like the more people like yourself and Dr. Paul and other people coming forward and sharing and talking and not being afraid of sharing your own personal story is so important. It'll change. I know it's going to happen.
I appreciate that.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
We'll see each other again.
I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsinscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.